for taking up your case of Michael Alonzo Robinson Jr. against the Commonwealth, and I was just asking if you want to reserve any of your 15 minutes for rebuttal.
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, please.
All right, then we'll be glad to hear from you.
Judge Humphreys, before she gets started, can you ask that people not be on an answering machine, or not an answering machine, but on a speaker, because I'm getting it sort of distorted, maybe like a 2 or 3 second delay.
Okay, yeah. If you're on a speakerphone, for one thing, it inhibits our ability to ask questions, so we would discourage that. You might also silence any cell phones that might be capable of interrupting your argument or our argument. And but Judge Alston's point is well taken. And if for some reason you feel compelled to use a speakerphone, please pause periodically so we can ask questions. All right, Ms. Newman.
Thank you, ma'am. Please the court. I'm Jennifer Newman. I'm counsel for the appellant, Michael Robinson Jr. What is before the court today, is an assignment of error regarding a multi-jurisdictional grand jury matter. Mr. Robinson was convicted of, for purposes of today's argument, of first-degree murder and use of a firearm in the commission of that murder. Those indictments were both brought before a multi-jurisdictional grand jury. Trial counsel at the time filed a motion.
Ms. Newman, this is Judge Humphreys. Let's see if we can focus this, because it's a fairly narrow issue, and it's an interesting one, and I think probably one of first impression here in Virginia. Go ahead.
I agree. It is an issue of first impression, at least as far as my research led me to believe.
Well, the statute requires the use of a court reporter, but it says it's for the benefit of the grand jury. Obviously, there was no court reporter here. I guess the question is, what's the legal effect of that? You're alleging it's a due process violation, and given that the purpose of the court reporter as specified in the statute is to assist the grand jurors, and I guess any benefit to the defendant is sort of ancillary since grand jury proceedings aren't normally recorded, where is the due process? I mean, I guess it would be procedural due process, but explain to us what you could rely on for the fact that certain statutory procedural rights were denied here.
Well, Judge, thank you for narrowing the issue to exactly what I think the issue is before the court. And the one thing that I would say to that is I think that pursuant to 19.2-215.9, I think that the necessity for a court reporter is actually a little more expansive than just for the use of the grand jury. Otherwise, paragraphs B and C, for instance, would not necessarily be useful. They would never be enacted. They would never be put to use. In particular, the transcripts are to be held by the circuit court, by the presiding judge, to be available for review either upon a motion of the defendant, which happened in this case, and subsection C, which isn't relevant to this particular case, but goes on to say whether or not someone who testifies in front of the grand jury would ever be subject to prosecution based on their testimony, and there is a clause in that subsection regarding the use of that transcript should a subsequent criminal proceeding come about. So I think it's slightly more expansive than it's just for the use of the multi-jurisdictional grand jury. And it is carved out separately as the regular grand jury proceeding. In particular,
Counsel, I have a question. There's some language in a case, and I would ask you to tell me how you overcome the language. There's a case of Vico versus Commonwealth, 10 Virginia Appeal 498. And let me read the language that I'm most focused on. It says, well, the better practice is to record all proceedings before the grand jury other than their deliberations. The primary function of recording the proceedings is to maintain a record and transcript for the use, benefit, and convenience of the grand juries. And this is the language I'm most concerned about. The record is not maintained to provide those under investigation with a record to assure that all formalities attended to the proceedings have been followed. Why doesn't that language suggest to us that this is not a substantive right, but rather is something else?
I think it certainly can, but again, I would just draw the court's attention to the language in the rest of the statute, that paragraph B and paragraph C would essentially, they would never come into play if it wasn't kept for other purposes. In particular, under paragraph B, if a motion is made to the presiding judge from the defense, then the presiding judge is required to then examine the transcript and determine whether or not it's necessary to disclose it. And in particular, what the courts are required to look at that point is whether or not it's reasonably necessary to inform the defendant of the nature of the evidence to be presented against him or to adequately prepare for his defense. And I think that's where the due process comes in. I think that's the showing that was required to be made. Unfortunately, in this case, we couldn't get anywhere because it was acknowledged immediately that there was no transcript, that there was no court order, that the statute had not been followed.
Would your analysis essentially require us to overrule the Vico case?
I don't believe so. I think it expands upon the Vico case, that obviously the General Assembly and the legislature meant to include some additional protections by having a court reporter present at the multi-jurisdictional grand jury. And I completely acknowledge that this is completely different than if it had been brought before a regular grand jury. I acknowledge that in my petition, and the other indictments were in this case. This was brought before the multi-jurisdictional grand jury, therefore those statutes that apply to it obviously are in effect. And there is this exception that the General Assembly enacted regarding the transcript and whether or not a motion is made by the defense, which in this case it was. And again, I think
for us to get to the point, and I appreciate your argument, it's a very good argument. Ultimately, for us to get to the point that you're trying to make, we're going to have to make the determination that the requirements are mandatory rather than directory. Why do you suggest that they are mandatory? Is it simply based on the statute?
Well, I think in part because the statute is fairly specific about the use of the transcripts. And in looking at some of the other cases regarding where the court has come down saying it's directory, not mandatory, I just don't know that they're really comparable. If you look at the Burns case, we're looking at 8.01-353, which is regarding whether or not the jury list has been turned over to defense. And in that case, that statute requires, first of all, a request by the defense, and then it's got some built-in exceptions right in it for whether or not there's some unanticipated circumstance. That's not what this statute is. This statute specifically says there shall be a court reporter, those transcripts will be held by the presiding judge, and then there's all these other provisions in that statute that say what can be done with those transcripts at a later date.
Can you point to a case for us that says that essentially defects, and I agree with you, there is clearly a defect here in the grand jury proceeding, but that defects in the grand jury proceedings are constitutional violations. Are you able to point to a case that says that?
Well, I think the closest case to that is the Peace case, which is 24 Virginia Appellate 397, 1997. In that case, the prosecutor inserted himself into the grand jury proceedings. The court found that that was, in fact, a constitutional violation, and the remedy was to reverse. They later rectified that by direct indicting in a separate grand jury proceeding and curing the defect. However, I think the Peace case speaks directly to if there is a violation of the statute regarding the grand jury proceedings that then affects the constitutional right, then the remedy is reversal.
Ms. Newman, this is Judge Humphreys. Let me follow up on Judge Alston's line of questions if I can. Direct your attention to the last sentence of subsection B of the statute, which says, upon motion to the presiding judge by a person indicted by a multi-jurisdiction grand jury, similar permission to review, note, or duplicate evidence shall be extended if it appears that the permission is consistent with the ends of justice and is necessary to reasonably inform such person of the nature of the evidence to be presented against him or to adequately prepare his defense. Now, given that there's clearly a procedural defect here, and given that you certainly properly raised the motion in the trial court, I guess directing your attention to that last sentence, what is the, basically, how were you harmed here? Because it's clearly not automatic, as I read that language. Judge Alston said of the Vico case earlier, which I think stands for the same proposition, that just, you know, asking doesn't necessarily guarantee you get it. So I guess my question would be, what's the evidence of the harm here? How was your client prejudiced in that he wasn't aware of the nature of the charges against him as a result of the indictment here, for example?
First of all, we absolutely concede that it's automatic and never meant to imply otherwise. The harm is that the circuit court judge could not even evaluate whether or not the ends of justice would have allowed a review of the transcripts because there was no transcript to review. And
that's
in that
ways, because we don't know that you were. You haven't made a showing of harm here. In other words, an indictment was returned, a trial was held where the charges were presented, evidence in support of them was presented, you had the opportunity to present any defense and cross-examine the witnesses, et cetera. So I guess my question is simply, how was this procedural defect somehow result in a defective indictment in such a way that it amounts to a due process violation? It seems to me the only way would be if somehow the indictment didn't properly acquaint your client of the charges against him.
Well, and I think twofold. One, I think it dovetails my earlier argument that without the circuit court being able to present that, that is why the statute should be considered mandatory rather than directory. Secondfold, we are not alleging that the indictment itself was defective and that it didn't reasonably notify the defendant. That was never raised at trial. I'm certainly not raising it on appeal. I think the difference is that the showing that's required under the statute is whether or not the defendant was entitled to know information regarding the evidence to be presented against him. It's very specific. It's not regarding the actual charge and whether or not he's on notice of what the charge is. It's regarding the evidence that's presented against him or the ability to adequately prepare his defense. And while I appreciate the Commonwealth's argument,
the sentence I read says that if you apply, if you seek permission to review, it shall be extended if it appears that permission is consistent with the ends of justice and is necessary to inform such person of the nature of the evidence presented against him. So there's a conjunctive there. So it seems to me in order for a defendant to get access to these transcripts, assuming they even existed, he would have to satisfy that two-pronged requirement, wouldn't he?
I absolutely agree. I guess the difference that I was making is that second prong our interpretation to the trial court and the argument that was presented was not that second prong is that we have to prove that the defendant wasn't adequately aware of the charge against him or the nature of the charge, but it's regarding the evidence that to be presented against him. I think that's the difference, and I think that's the impetus behind the statute requiring a transcript, is because obviously the transcript would have taken down evidence that was presented to the grand jury, which is different than just a procedural defect in the indictment regarding the nature of the case and whether or not the defendant knows what he's charged with. But we're not alleging that. We're alleging that had the transcript been prepared, the circuit court would have had the opportunity to review it to see if we met prong one and two. And our allegation is that we don't know what was presented to the grand jury. There was never any testimony presented to the trial court. There was simply a statement made by the Commonwealth that Detective Goldman presented hearsay evidence. Well, we don't know what that hearsay evidence was. We don't know if there was impeachment hidden in that. We don't know if Detective Goldman would have been an impeachment witness because we don't know what Detective Goldman presented to the grand jury.
Are you suggesting, counsel, that the statute in this context provides an additional discovery mechanism for a criminal defendant?
I think it provides an additional review by the circuit court regarding discovery. But the review by the circuit court in and of itself couldn't happen in this case.
What's the proper remedy, then?
Had it been before the trial court, the proper remedy would have been to dismiss the indictment, and the Commonwealth attorney would have had the same remedy that they had in Peace once that happened at the appellate level, to bring it back in front of a new grand jury, a regular grand jury if they chose, and bring those indictments. At this point, the remedy is reversal as it was in Peace, and the Commonwealth can do as they please in terms of whether or not they decide to present the murder and use of a firearm in front of another grand jury.
So if I understand your argument, you conceded the indictments are not defective in themselves, on their face, but you're arguing that the remedy for this procedural violation of the statute is necessarily dismissal of the indictments that are otherwise not defective. Is that your argument?
I am, and I'm relying on the Reed case, in that if an indictment is defective so that it is in violation of the Constitution, and again, tying in the due process argument, then the remedy is that the matter be reversed. At this point, obviously, it has to be reversed because it deprived him of his due process rights pursuant to the Reed case.
I'm not suggesting that this is the only remedy available to you, but why wouldn't a bill of particulars have worked in this case?
Well, I think a bill of particulars would have spoken to the nature of the case and the charge against him. I mean, bill of particulars, you know, time, place, circumstances. It does not speak specifically to the evidence presented against him, which, again, I think is the remedy, or could have been the remedy that the statute had provided had there been a transcript and the circuit court had been able to review it. So I think it's a little particular.
If I were looking at this as a trial judge, and I kind of harken back to this from time to time, if I'm a trial judge and I say, okay, there should be a transcript of this thing, and there isn't a transcript, Commonwealth attorney, what happened here? Commonwealth gives me some explanation as to why this didn't happen, and I say to the Commonwealth, well, it seems to me that there's at least at a minimum a procedural requirement that is defective here, and so therefore. It appears from the statute that the defendant is entitled to some information, and so I would be actually encouraging counsel, what would you suggest is the remedy for this? Counsel, why don't you submit a bill of particulars, and I would encourage you to be very liberal in your request, and I'll take a look at it, and the Commonwealth will be required to meet its obligation. Why wouldn't that be a more appropriate thing to do than when we can't really point to any prejudice that's been sustained in this case? The appropriate remedy or the appropriate thing to have occurred in this case.
I think your proposed remedy would have been appropriate had the bill of particulars had the trial judge gone on and expanded upon a bill of particulars. A bill of particulars, in my experience, simply provides some additional information regarding time, place, circumstances. It doesn't necessarily get to the heart of the evidence that would be presented against the defendant, which again is what paragraph subsection B of the statute that we're discussing talked about is the evidence presented against him. And there was no allegation in this case that Mr. Robinson didn't know the time, place, or circumstances that this alleged murder was to have occurred. It was whether or not the evidence that was presented to the grand jury held any additional information in that evidence that would have been appropriate to disclose to the defense in terms of his ability under the due process rights and other constitutional rights to adequately prepare his defense.
I think what troubles all of us, and maybe you can help us with this difficulty, is that you're alleging a constitutional due process, a constitutional violation in a set of circumstances that, as you conceded, in the normal course of events with a regular grand jury would never have applied. And you're suggesting that because this court reporter wasn't, there was simply no court reporter present during the grand jury's taking of evidence, that automatically constitutes a due process violation and dismissal of the indictment on some pretty serious charges, when that would not be available under any other set of circumstances with an ordinary grand jury. And I'm trying to understand how it automatically rises to the level of constitutional import when it's clearly a statutory defect that doesn't provide any substantive rights unless you make a clear showing, which your argument is you couldn't do, and therefore didn't do. But help us with that.
I can certainly appreciate the court's pause. I think that the nature of the statute in and of itself gives us that ability. It is different than the regular grand jury for reasons that I assume the General Assembly knows much more than I do as to why they enacted a statute that allowed for what appears to be, under other circumstances, would have been discovery. But it does allow for that. Otherwise, that language would not have been in there. And it allows for a circuit court judge to do an analysis based on a request by the defense. And because that was not here, that's our allegation. That then made the indictment defective because the procedure itself wasn't followed. It didn't allow the circuit court to make the analysis that's allowed under the statute. And we don't know. Maybe the circuit court would have done the analysis and found that we didn't meet the two-prong test, and then we wouldn't be making the argument that we're making here today. However, the Commonwealth chose not to have a court reporter there, chose to actually make argument at trial court that testimony wasn't even presented, so they didn't have to follow the statute, and therefore there's no way Mr. Robinson could have been prejudiced, and so this should just all lie there in the trial court. And I'm asking the court to consider that as a very disingenuous argument, that there is a procedural statute that's out there, that it is very specific regarding the court reporter. It's a shall. We're asking the court to determine that that's mandatory, that then requires that the circuit court have the ability to look at a transcript if requested by defense. If we then meet the two-prong test, great, the defense gets it. If we don't, that's a whole separate argument to be made at a later date in a different case. But to say that the Commonwealth can choose to not have a court reporter present and then argue that there's no way for defense to be able to present any information regarding a constitutional violation. That's what we're asking the court not to do. I think it does create a defect in the indictment process, not in the actual piece of paper of the indictment, that requires this court to consider reversal in order to remedy it.
Ms. Newman, Judge Alston and I have basically chewed up your rebuttal time, so I'm still going to give you your 2 minutes. But we're going to hear from Ms. Bumgarner now.
Thank you. May it please the court. One thing I'd like to start with is that the issue is not here that the circuit court was prevented from making the analysis of whether or not Mr. Robinson made a showing that he needed the information. The circuit court specifically found that he did not make any such showing. And the circuit court doesn't need to be able to review the evidence that's in front of the grand jury to decide if the defendant has made a particularized showing.
You would agree here that there was indeed a defect in the grand jury proceeding. You would agree with that, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would agree that it is directory, but I believe it directs a court reporter to be present.
All right, now, kind of follow me if you can. I'm going to take you through a process. If indeed this is something that the legislature developed that is some sort of procedural right, at least as at a minimum, or a procedural prerogative, let me use that term, available to the defendant. If the transcript doesn't exist, aren't we sort of going in a circle if we say, okay, there's this procedural prerogative that's created by statute available to the defendant. Commonwealth didn't do it here, but no big deal, no harm, no foul, and so we're essentially reading away the statute and giving it no effect whatsoever?
Well, for starters, I don't believe this was a procedural prerogative created for the defendant's benefit. I think it was created for the grand jury's benefit. It also talks about special counsel being able to go back in and review that. The portion that allows the defendant upon a special demonstration to get access to it is really not the driving force behind the statute.
What is the driving force behind the statute in your view?
I believe it's for the benefit of the grand jury itself and for the benefit of the special counsel. It really makes no sense for a defendant to have some sort of greater discovery rights just by virtue of being before a different grand jury.
Let me follow up on Judge Austin's question. What's the Commonwealth's position then as to why the General Assembly included the language in the last sentence of subsection B of the statute that I quoted earlier, the two-part requirement that must appear consistent with the ends of justice, permission to review is consistent with the ends of justice, and that it's necessary to inform such person of the nature of the evidence to be presented against him or to adequately prepare his defense. Now, you know, your opponent asserts that was done simply, you know, we want it because we want to do these things. And I hear you saying, well, that's not good enough, and the trial court made a finding to that effect. But what would be an example of what would be good enough then if you're giving your answer to Judge Alston's question?
Well, for instance, with bills of particulars, frequently they're presented in child abuse cases that are much more difficult to pin down the exact time and location of abuse, where it's much more difficult to prepare a defense because with child witnesses you have less specificity. I mean, this is a murder. There's no question of when the murder occurred, of where the murder occurred.
But let me do it this way. Suppose I were counsel for a defendant and who'd been indicted by a multi-jurisdictional grand jury, and I said, Your Honor, I want access to the court reporter's transcript done by the court reporter because I want to find out whether or not this indictment was based on the uncorroborated testimony of the victim or whether other witnesses have corroborated. Why would that not be, or would that be sufficient, and if not, why not?
I don't think this creates some sort of fishing expedition or a general discovery right, the same way as I argued in my brief, the bill of particulars, you must make a particularized need. Why is this case different from the others? Getting the funds to hire an expert, you must make a particularized need. Why do I need an expert in this case? and just saying you want a preview of the evidence has never been found to convey extra rights upon a defendant.
Even if we weren't of a nature of a mind to call it an additional right, isn't it at least an ancillary benefit available to the defendant? Even if we have to take your point and say, okay, these things, these transcripts are not created to create some sort of substantive right for the defendant, but rather they're simply to aid in the grand jury process for the benefit of the grand jury itself. If we take that argument, and then we take the additional language that was cited by Judge Humphreys, which at a minimum creates some sort of ancillary benefit for the defendant, wouldn't you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay, and so if that ancillary benefit has been created by statute, and that beneficial prerogative, I'm coming up with terms, I'm creating them out of thin air here, is not available to the defendant because of circumstances, why doesn't the defendant have a remedy available to him in that context?
Well, I think there are two things going on. First of all, the burden, the defendant must meet their burden first. This would be a completely different case if the defendant could point to some actual prejudice or harm to him. But also, the case law states that if there's not a remedy presented, it's merely directory. It's not mandatory. There's no constitutional right here that's violated because of the statutory violation.
And you would agree that if we came to the conclusion that this statute created a mandatory benefit, mandatory right in favor of the defendant, that you would lose the case?
No, not because even if there were a mandatory right for the defendant, it would still be reviewed on harmless error analysis because there's no structural defect here.
Counsel, what is an example of how a defendant would show prejudice when there is no transcript available?
Well, in this case, we would have the benefit of hindsight. At some point during trial, the defense counsel had argued undue surprise for something that was shocking or unexpected that happened at trial, and they could point to it. If that had been argued in this case, the judge at the time could conceivably have had some sort of hearing to determine if this was known beforehand.
But then the Commonwealth would come in and say that that's waived because it hasn't been raised timely.
If it had happened during trial?
Yes. Wouldn't the Commonwealth then claim that it hasn't been raised timely? It should have been raised prior to going to trial as opposed to after a plea has been entered and the trial has begun?
Well,
it seems to me it puts the defendant in a pretty big box. The defendant has to guess what might have been available had the transcript been available, and then the Commonwealth say, well, you should have raised it earlier when the defendant really didn't know it was in the transcript because there was no transcript. So it seems like we're going in a circle here if we take that approach.
Everyone was on notice in this case that the transcripts didn't exist.
Judge Austin's point is enshrined in the statute. The statute itself, or the code says, that any defect in the indictment has to be raised before trial. And that's what this would be, wouldn't it? A defect in the indictment, or at least in the process of the indictment. And if it's not raised before trial, I'm sure the Commonwealth would be arguing at the top of its lungs that it was waived.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's all right.
The defect was raised before trial, though, because Mr. Robinson's trial counsel made a motion to get access to the transcripts.
Well, this one was, but not in Judge Austin's ultimate scenario.
I might be confused then.
Counsel, can you give us an example of proof of prejudice before a case goes to trial? When there's no transcript available?
I guess conceivably if some sort of witness changed their story. And the defense knew of a witness who had told various stories for instance, if the Commonwealth presented some Brady evidence and said, this witness has testified in front of the grand jury, they're now telling me something else, and there's no longer any sort of record of what that witness said previously.
Maybe if the grand jury members were not sworn. I guess I'm trying to think of one too. If the grand jury members were not sworn prior to hearing the matter.
Correct. Or perhaps there wasn't a quorum of the grand jury. Items like that. But in this case, there hasn't been any showing of prejudice whatsoever. This was an exceedingly strong case. And Mr. Robinson simply didn't have a right to just have a preview of the evidence, and I don't believe the statute created a right for him that does not otherwise exist anywhere in Virginia law. Would not have had a right to a preliminary hearing. He's had a right to a recitation of the facts sufficient to inform him of the offenses for which he's going to be tried, the murder and the possession of the firearm. He presumes that the transcript is his for the asking, and in this case, the trial court specifically found that he had not met that burden to overcome the secrecy inherent in grand jury proceedings.
So your initial position is that it doesn't matter because by not making the showing, he wouldn't have gotten it even if it had existed. Is that your initial position?
Yes. He has to make some sort of showing extrinsic to the grand jury minutes to get them.
Of course, if we had the transcript, then, of course, this court could review that on appeal and determine whether or not the trial court made the right call in that regard.
Well, I think they're not really necessary. The Commonwealth still has its Brady obligations. Those don't disappear just because the evidence wasn't transcribed. So there's no reason to suspect, really, that anything in this grand jury transcript would have been helpful to him at all. This detective did not testify. The witnesses who testified at trial did not appear before the grand jury, and no Brady evidence arose in that grand jury that would trigger the obligations to turn it over. And finally, in this case, there was a bill of particulars done, and there was no objection to that bill of particulars, but it somehow did not adequately advise the defense so that they could go forward without the transcript.
Well, of course, how would you respond to Ms. Newman's argument that what a bill of particulars does is advise you of the nature of the charges against you and fills in details concerning, you know, place, time, you know, location, things of that nature, whereas the statute refers to learning what the evidence is against you, which I guess is arguably a broader term than just what the charges are.
Well, I think the statute refers to the nature of the evidence, which at best, if it really is something different than the nature of the charges, I think would include, is it witnesses, is it scientific?
Eyewitness testimony versus forensic evidence versus something else? Is that what you're talking about?
Correct. At best, that's what the nature of the evidence is. I don't think, if Mr. Robinson would have been apprised of the nature of the evidence, if he'd been told, it's going to be witness. It's going to be all the identity evidence is going to come through eyewitness testimony. He would have been apprised of the nature of the evidence, and there would have been nothing else for him to gain. He was certainly not entitled to know that there was a dying declaration and a double-blind sequential lineup from the surviving victim.
Your argument is essentially that in this case, there is indeed a defect in the grand jury proceeding, that there may well be a case out there where this kind of defect in the grand jury proceeding may be significant, but in this case, there has been no significance shown, so therefore the defendant does not derive any ancillary benefit from whatever the statute may suggest. Is that your argument?
Yes, it is. If there are no further questions, I urge you to affirm. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Baumgartner. Ms. Newman, you have 2 minutes.
Just very briefly, I'll just say that the court was asking the questions that exactly I have spent months trying to come up with an answer as to how the defense, specifically in this case, would have been able to prove that there was a specific violation of his constitutional rights. And again, I end up in the same circular argument. I think that the Commonwealth's argument that the nature of the evidence would have been sufficient to if he had been presented with information that said all of the information will come from an eyewitness testimony. Maybe that's sufficient, I'm not certain, but we couldn't get to that point because the circuit court couldn't make that evaluation. And even that alone would have been something more than what occurred for Mr. Robinson. What occurred for Mr. Robinson is we didn't follow the statute, there's no court reporter, hearsay was presented at the grand jury, and our hands are wiped clean now. We should go forward with the indictment. Our argument is that the statute says what it says. There would be absolutely no effect to the statute if that language meant nothing. In subsection B in the last sentence, or subsection C where it talks about the transcript, if there's a subsequent criminal proceeding against a witness, that those would have no effect if it wasn't mandatory that there be a court reporter present, and that then allows the court and the circuit court to make an additional analysis about whether or not there's an ends of justice requirement that requires that the nature of the evidence be disclosed to the defense in order to adequately prepare for his defense. We don't know what Detective Goldman said. We don't know if there was impeachment evidence there. We don't know if he presented evidence that the eyewitness changed her testimony. We don't know any of that because the statute wasn't followed. So we would ask that this court put some teeth behind the statute and find that it's mandatory, and that if it's not followed, that the appropriate remedy at that point is a dismissal of the indictment.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Newman, Ms. Baumgartner. We appreciate your argument this morning. We have Mr. Reed with us now.
Yes, Your Honor.